A few moments later, I pinched another roach from the cup and popped it in my mouth, trying super hard not to think about what I was doing. And you have to understand, these were big-ass African-type cockroaches. They looked like giant water bugs. But I just chomped down hard and bit into this sucker. This second one, the live one, tasted kind of salty. I could feel it squirming around in there for just a beat, and then when I bit down on it, all I could think was that it was salty and gross. But I kept it down. I had to fight it, but I kept it down. And I'll be damned, I started to feel like I had a little more energy, so I ate a couple more. Ate a couple of worms, too. So that's how I got by the rest of the way, eating bugs and worms from the flower pots outside my window, switching from toilet tea to dirty rainwater tea, doing whatever I had to do to survive. That was an excerpt from Gaddafi's Point Guard, the incredible story of a professional basketball player trapped in Libya's civil war, by Alex Awumi with Daniel Paisner. I'm Jason Squamata. This is the Gaddafi's Point Guard edition of Book Circle Online.
From the Library of Maria Menounos, this is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
I am Jason Squamata for Book Circle Online. I am here with my ravishing co-hosts,
Mark Savage,
Kate Fanker,
and let's do a little round robin. Let's talk about how we felt about this book, Mark.
Yeah, I wouldn't normally read a book like this. Eye wrenching, gut opening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go for that kind of thing.
What do you, yes.
But I don't want my eyes opened. But I really enjoyed this book. I was punching the air at certain points as he made his escape from civil war. I really enjoyed it.
Now, did you feel like that you were pumping your fist in the air more so than you would be in a fictional rendition of a situation like that?
It's a good question. I don't know. Perhaps because there's a hokiness to the narrative here that you might not forgive if it hadn't happened to a professional athlete.
Right.
Good then point. Write a book.
Yes.
Yeah, I
agree there. And there are lots of things that happen that are very anti-heroic and very human.
Mm-hmm.
Things like where you're like when he's stuck in the apartment building as the uprising is happening and his apartment building is taken over by the insurgents and his neighbor is dying in the hallway and the neighbor's daughter is being raped by an insurgent soldier and he can't do anything about it. Like, he's about to go for one of the insurgents' guns that had been put down and try to do something, but as soon as he goes for it, he's noticed and they basically shove him back into his own apartment at gunpoint. They don't understand each other's language. There's nothing. I mean, he could get himself killed, but it's not going to stop anything from happening.
Mm-hmm,
and it's just a horrible situation that is very unmovie-like.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like that particular scenario was very unmovie-like. It's like so like anticlimactic and depressing. Like stuff he wants to act against. And it's like, oh yeah, you got me at gunpoint. I guess I'm going back inside now and I'm going to cry.
Right. I'm going to shout some expletives at you in a language that you don't understand because I feel like maybe you won't kill me, but I need to get this off my chest.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to go cry in a shadowy room and eat bugs and worms until somebody saves me.
Yeah.
That's one thing I found really interesting is that, Alex Awumi is an athlete, and there's a certain kind of language in the sporting world that there's a lot of positive thinking, there's a lot of repetition of mantras, and there's a point where he uses that to carry him through some of the experiences he's going through. But there are things that you can't explain away with, you know, 100%. We're going to keep giving more than the opposite team.
There are things
if the opposite
you can't
team
train for.
Have
yeah.
guns and
yeah.
they're raping someone, and you're just going to. You're going to cry quietly in your apartment.
Yeah,
and
your own image
you
of yourself, like your way that you think of yourself is completely not applicable. You can't apply it to this situation.
Right.
You'd think maybe you could, but instead you're a helpless baby. But in this situation.
And yet he keeps, in it, I guess it's to survive and to make sense of what he's been through. He keeps finding this narrative, this kind of almost redemptive narrative that plays against a lot of the reality, because this isn't a book that really explains to us what was going on in Libya. He's very much a naive guy who likes to play basketball.
Yeah.
And came out of Libya with not really any more understanding of the place than he went in with. He's this confused guy trapped in a very strange situation. And he kind of bounces around based on the luck and judgment and goodwill of other people in a way that it's this kind of almost this kind of picaresque novel. It's almost like Candide, where it's this guy bouncing around and the irony of the deeper things that are happening to people around him, the terrible things that are happening that he manages to avoid. There are almost two narratives. There's the one that he's writing for himself, the personal one, where he's maybe discovered some things about himself by surviving this ordeal, and the one that's happening to the world at large.
Yeah, like what was actually going on, and when he's stuck in the apartment, and he doesn't know who these, like the soldiers out there, what side are they?
What side is the side?
What, like he doesn't even know how he is perceived. Like what side he would be perceived to be on.
Because he just plays basketball.
Yeah, right. And so, I mean, he is living in a Gaddafi family apartment. However, the teams are basically half slaves and abused by the Gaddafis. So how do you even know what someone on the other side, someone from the country who doesn't speak your language, what they even think about you? Do they think of you as an American? Do they think of you as part of the Gaddafis?
Right.
Like, and, well, why are they not killing him? We'll never find out.
And he won't. The sporting world is not one where you can sell out. The concept of morality in sport is so dubious at best, where you sign deals with people. Is there a completely altruistic and moral sport that's organized by moral and altruistic people? No, you just play.
Yeah. Right.
Or maybe in the Bush leagues, I mean, in its purest state, like when he speaks of falling in love with the sport of basketball in Nigeria.
Oh yeah.
It's this beautiful
thing. The game itself.
Yeah. And he's, and there are these pirated VHS tapes being brought to him from the United States.
Absolutely. The glamour of America.
Yeah. Where he, I think, for that reason, because he's sort of outside the moral questions of these struggles that he's a witness to, he's a great interface for the reader.
Absolutely.
I mean, at least for this reader.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
I mean, as you said, Mark, I don't really read books like this very often. And Kate, I don't know if you have more of a nonfiction palette in general.
I love to read nonfiction, but it's usually about subjects that I'm personally engaged with.
Right.
Like the arts or the arts.
Yeah. Yes. And this book was recommended to me by Kevin Undergaro. And I was leery at first because it's about sports, which I know nothing about. And it's
You don't like to talk about your college. Scholarships.
I'm not going to bring that up because there's some very painful memories attached to that. I had it all, the world in the palm of my hand, and yet I blew it because I just like bitches and blow too much, and the game fell by the wayside. But be that as it may, here I am with this book, sports and current events, and all these things that I don't know if the average reader like needs such a stripped down sort of disconnected interface as we get with Alex Awumi, who's just all about the game and all about his personal struggle and is in the middle of these great iconic history shifting moments that he's a sort of witnessing from the bombed out gutters and shattered windows of buildings looking out on these events. But you know, maybe the man in the street knows more about what was actually going down in Libya than I do, but I was dreading reading this, to tell you the truth. And but when I finally sat down with it, I was shocked at the literary quality of this memoir. And I'm not sure of Daniel Paisner's background as a, you know, as a ghostwriter or as a facilitator of memoirs, but I feel like the raw material of Awumi's struggle, you know,
and clearly a very engaging personality.
Yes, yes, yes.
I completely found him very likable.
Oh no, yeah. Super charming, yeah. And you know, and a kind of abiding selfishness in his view that I also found very engaging because it seemed part and parcel of you know, his character as an athlete.
Absolutely.
You know,
and very much like an artist of any other kind. It's yeah. exactly the same, like right. the artist who escaped from the Hitler's threat, like, and they weren't involved on any side. They just saw some shit going down and they were getting out right. if they could because yeah. they wanted to pursue their pursuits. And, yeah. you know, they went to the American Southwest or they went wherever right, and right, like, right, right. And they just got out of there yeah. and may or may not have had such incredible, like, incredible, gotten into some incredible snaggles along right. the way, like Alex here well, did. Well,
and even, I mean, apart from the burning cities and the shifting of history, I mean, just the pure athletic aspect of the memoir, it really, it, like, put, you know, a lot of my artistic, writerly, you know, sniveling in perspective, because I don't, you know, like, I'll read the biographies of artists who have kind of, you know, spotty, ebbing and flowing, you know, periods of commitment and passionate obsession with their work, you know, for the most part. But an athlete doesn't have that luxury.
You can't do that.
Yeah. No, you can't.
He, you know? I mean, I actually found a lot of the early chapters where he was detailing his high school and college uh-huh. and then playing and subsequently his failure to be drafted in the NBA.
Right.
Found that really compelling.
Yeah.
Because what do you do when you're a 17, 18, 19 year old guy, uh-huh. physically very fit? And he saw a point where he could have had it all right. in his mind.
Right.
He tells us he was a very good academic student. He could have gone possibly to an Ivy League school,
mm-hmm.
Could have played as a quarterback for a college team, could have played right. as a, you know, he wanted to have it all. And there's a point where he ends up, because he tries to hedge his bets so
yeah.
much, maybe failing.
Right. Well, yes. And to remark briefly on, you know, how remarkable, I mean, his array of aptitudes was uh-huh. that he was
yeah.
a great basketball player, a great football player. And because of his, you know, father, you know, his parents imposing these, you know, these values on him. I mean, he like academic excellence mm-hmm. was not like something, he just took it as a given that was part of the mix. And,
yeah.
you know, he was like driving himself to be a great man, you know,
yeah.
but in, you know, in the language of the book, in this, you know, kind of, slow dribbling, kind of sauntering, swaggering sort of way. But, you know, if you break down what his actual achievements consisted of, I mean, this is an incredibly hardworking, mm-hmm. driven guy.
And yeah. he's hardworking and he's driven. And essentially, as far as his career goes,
uh-huh.
he's very much a journeyman.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
not an NBA star.
Right.
Yeah.
He's
a working athlete.
He's
yeah.
a working
yeah.
athlete who has done well to be paid for what he does.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that he ends up in Macedonia, in France,
yeah, well, and
back
he's
in the States, in the fact that he ends up in Libya at all speaks to
right.
the fact
right.
that he hasn't succeeded on the highest level. But it's a reminder of the in sport that there's a whole wave of people you see as mediocre,
right?
Who are still exceptional,
yeah,
because the amount of people that want to succeed in basketball, for example.
Right. Yeah.
Huge.
Well, and those people that we would consider mediocre just in comparison to, you know, the
right.
people with all the endorsement deals or whatever are putting more work into it on a daily basis.
And they're a tiny amount below
uh-huh.
in terms of
right.
ability.
Yeah.
Tiny
right.
amount.
Yeah.
But that tiny amount
because that door is so
huge.
Down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that for, like, throughout the various ebbs and flows of his career and the kind of strange impulsive decisions he makes, but, like, yeah. wherever he ends up, he's recalibrating his strategy. I mean, his...
Absolutely. This will get me this for this year, but then next year I'm going to be here.
Yeah, because the goal is the NBA. And yeah. so, you know, up until this, you know, catastrophic shattering of the self that happens when he's confronting all this real life horror Absolutely. In Libya, it's always, okay, so that seemed to knock me back a few steps, but if I do this and this and this... then I can get into the NBA that way. And
which is like a 60-year-old local actor uh-huh. in a theater production saying, right. you know, now I'm King Lear. If I do this King Lear right. in this local theater production, this might be my shot because yeah. it's got some sponsorship and people might come.
Right.
And that the Hollywood dream, the Broadway dream
uh-huh.
might still be there.
Right.
But it's compressed into the first half of a life because athletes it's the pressure on a teenager, and I mean that's the thing that really
yeah. right, because well, you're like looking for that window yeah. of peak like physical
he's leaving
performance.
High school and he could yeah. go anywhere
right.
He, like he said, if he wanted to play football he would have gone to Texas, if he uh-huh. wanted to play basketball he could have gone to UCLA,
right,
but he tried to do both
yeah
and academia
yeah
and that's because when you're a teenager you don't know what you want to do.
Right. Well, yeah. And, you know, and I'm not entirely sure that this is at all pertinent, but I want to say it. Like, Laurence Olivier talked about King Lear and how he felt like, King Lear and Romeo, to play Romeo, you need to be physically, you know, between like, you know, 15 and 21.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you, to really understand the ironies of that character, you have to be between 30 and 40.
Ha.
And, so
no one can play it.
Well, yeah. And to play King Lear, you need the physical vigor of a 17 to 21 year old.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you like can't get your head around it mentally until you're actually in your 70s. And, so
yeah.
I think sporting genius uh-huh. often seems to be this genius that isn't understood. Like uh-huh. you can be an imbecile,
right?
And understand the physics of how a ball moves.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And not be able to explain it. You just do it.
Right.
And I think sometimes that's where you see the high school college kids who just understand something.
Uh-huh.
Then they get to a point where they doubt themselves for the first time, and right. they're finished.
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah.
They have to
That's
think
it.
In that external yeah. sort of way, and it's just...
You're done.
Right. Yeah. What's the parable of the ant and the centipede, you know? And,
yeah.
How do you move all those legs all at once? And then as soon as you think about it, you're finished. Wait a minute. Instantly crippled. Yeah. But, and something I was thankful about in the book as a non... sports person, but with this, you know, like renewed abiding, you know, admiration for what that path requires. But the play-by-play aspect mm-hmm. of a basketball narrative that was really saved, like for the last climactic game.
Yep. Yep.
You know,
yeah.
it goes there occasionally just so we'll know what everyone's aptitudes reflect about their character and where they are in this pecking mm-hmm. order. But we didn't get a play-by-play basketball game with all the terminology and stuff until the, like, you know, climactic game in Alexandria
yeah.
where...
Which
you know,
is, by the book,
uh-huh.
Hollywood ending,
yeah.
isn't it? And that's... I found that really interesting that he... One of the greatest points in the book is when he makes his escape from Libya to mm-hmm. Egypt under such duress.
Yeah.
He's desperate to get home. And his former
yeah.
coach, who has also escaped, says, come and play in Alexandria. And he does.
Uh-huh.
He makes his decision to not go home, but to stay for 6 weeks, 2 months.
Right.
Without seeing any of his family or his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And he stays to play basketball to get his head right. And then he not only does that, but he helps this team sweep to the playoffs.
Right.
And win the championship.
Right.
And win it, you know, right at the end of the game.
Yeah.
With a shot right at the end. I loved the almost the predictable excitement. You knew they were going to win
sure
somehow,
mm-hmm.
even
yeah.
though this is nonfiction.
Yeah.
And the way in which somehow that, coupled with his dad recovering from his illness, it put this incredible positive gloss on the end. That somehow, in his own sporting world, his own personal sporting, you know, the world in which that's really important to him, which is sporting success, he's come out of this experience and he survived, and everything's great again. Right. But there's all these questions to me about what does it mean when he gets home? What does his girlfriend really think about
right,
him?
Right, right,
deciding
right.
To play basketball. Do now?
What does it say about him? What does he do now? That ending, it almost made me feel like the ending of Taxi Driver when
he's a hero.
Travis Bickle has just killed some people.
Right, right. And he's getting letters from Jodie Foster's parents
saying, well done, you're a hero.
Yeah.
And it puts this nice spin on something which was actually a bloodbath.
But it's bittersweet and weird because he's still sitting there.
I wouldn't say this was quite in that realm, but it made me think of that.
Yeah.
Because it leads to these questions of...
Right. Well, because his... I mean, despite that he's laying it all out for us, and this is, you know, in his voice, what other kind of literary controversies or, you know, conceits Daniel Pazner is imposing, that, you know, this feels like an authentic transcription of what he went through. And there's, you know, he's learning things about himself, but there's just this fundamental selfishness to his character. And, you know, he's a religious person and he loves his family and he's respectful of what his family has given him. But I think when you're that committed to, when you've like found a verb that seems to define you and all of your hopes for the future or self-fulfillment or actualization, like hinge on your obsessive practice of that verb, it, like, you know, by necessity, you know, obviously makes you this, you know, very kind of myopic person. And I could not, after everything that, because I mean, you would think like his experiences in Libya and what he witnessed and, you know, all this devastation and all this peril and him, you know, almost beating a man to death and recognizing that it would have like broken him down to this state. I kept expecting the story to go that way, where he's like, I don't care about basketball anymore.
Yeah.
But so it's like simultaneously sort of triumphant and exciting and empowering that he, you know, he again, you know, like manages to put his psyche together through the sport that defines him. But at the same time, you're not going back to your family?
There's a denial
dying
to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I knew after I read this book, I was going to look him up on Wikipedia to see where he is now, because this all happened a couple of years ago.
Right, right.
And I knew he would still be playing basketball somewhere.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't be in the NBA.
Right.
And he wouldn't be a big star. He would be... And he is. He's in England. He's playing in it. Which, you know, as journeyman leagues go, there's one for you right there.
Sure.
Where, you know, it's not a sport over there.
Right.
And he's playing and he's...
That's
being
perfect,
successful and he's winning things in a small league, and then who's to say next year he isn't somewhere else?
Yeah,
I knew that was going to happen.
Right.
There's something about his ordeal that doesn't change him.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 And that's that's weirdly uplifting, and
in
yet
a way,
at the same time, sort of like depressing.
I agree with you on the selfishness.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't ever put me off him.
Right.
As a person.
No.
I find it very... I understand it very much.
I totally do, too. And I feel like...
It's almost admirable, actually.
It is. I found it quite admirable. And that he did really consider the fact that his... Because he thinks of his family a lot and is in contact with them a lot.
Yeah.
And he considers many times what his father always said, that if something is good... that he would always answer, if it is good for you, it's good for me.
Right.
Yeah.
And when it gets to this really intense place where his father is home dying,
right,
and Alex is out making choices about his basketball career, but would his father really want him to come home and hover over his deathbed, or would he want him to go kick some ass on the court?
Well, yes.
I mean, I really felt like, and he'd been hearing that ever since he was growing up, so I just...
But at the same time, a part of me was like, okay, but is that setting up is the big shift in his character? And I, you know,
oh, yeah.
And this thing is so, you know, vividly written that, you know, we can like speak of him as a literary character with impunity, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. but like, is the big shift for him to, you know, to realize that like him making that the same decision that his father makes,
mm-hmm.
like what's okay for my family,
mm-hmm.
you know, that would have been like a kind of breakthrough that, okay, this actually, you know, my father has sacrificed all this to put me through basketball, but me, you know, like putting that aside and, mm-hmm. and hovering over my father's yeah. pointlessly over my father's diabetic coma.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of sacrifice might mean something.
Another really big thing that kept going on through the book was the influence of other people.
Mm-hmm.
So many, pretty much every single thing that happened to him, it wasn't like even his sticking, you know, sticking to basketball and going mm-hmm. to Alexandria instead of yeah. going home.
It's
that wasn't,
yeah.
yeah, it wasn't because he was laying under the blanket in the, you know, in the stowaway bus
mm-hmm.
to get at, getting out of there. It wasn't like he was huddled under the blanket and had a revelation and decided to take off. No, it was because his coach got through to him on the phone and talked him
yeah.
into it.
Yeah,
and he's
yeah.
like, "It yeah. was yeah."
The voice of God is a coach.
Yeah,
and the coach is just saying, "Do you want to play?"
And it's Coach Sharif, and I couldn't help it but picture Omar Sharif.
But not only that, but all through the book, the part of what made the whole story so stressful and entertaining
uh-huh.
was because this guy, he really was in a position where, like, especially when he's trapped in his apartment in Libya
uh-huh.
and everyone has abandoned him
yeah.
and he doesn't speak the language. He has no idea what's going on. All he knows is that if he tries to leave his apartment, he's could easily get shot
yes.
and has actually been threatened at gunpoint and back into his apartment.
Right.
He looks out onto the street. There are people getting gunned down on the street.
Yeah.
He is just trapped. He's like trapped for weeks in his apartment with 2 days worth of food, like trying to deal.
And half of which he gives away.
Oh, yeah, yeah. yeah.
And
yeah.
He ends up he gets out because of a friend finally getting through to him on the phone,
mm-hmm.
and then because of those kids
right.
that he had run
yeah.
into on the way in,
yeah.
who
well,
like who knew the back streets and like they didn't
yeah.
even speak the language.
He's relying on
people all the way through, and it often people who don't even speak the language,
right,
and it
yeah.
makes it just like he doesn't actually know what. Like, they could, he knows, even these kids, they could be taking him on a wild goose chase to get killed or
right.
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He knows
right.
this.
That, it's a great detail. The kids that he sees every day kicking the ball around in the
yeah.
street.
Right.
And then suddenly carrying machetes and
yeah.
guns.
Well,
and now what? What does that mean?
Yeah.
And luckily they know him, they recognize him, and they help him.
Like him regardless
right.
of whatever it means.
Well, because he's like a hero to them
yeah.
and they don't have a vested interest. Like a coach does in his athletic development,
yeah.
And I like that is like this incredible bleak crossroads moment because there are no coaches, and there've been all these.
That's it. There's no one.
Yeah. And so, but like, who is he left with in that room? He's like talking to childhood versions of himself in a mirror.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he's like. The calls from the coach might, like, you know, like, mobilize him to make a more decisive, like, you know, leap to save his life. But what's actually keeping him alive in that room is him keeping the counsel of his more innocent selves. And I felt like those children were, like, a reflection of that. Like, the
mm-hmm.
coaches are going to help you move forward and make decisions. But, like, the child that you were and these kids
yeah.
who just think you're awesome,
yeah.
who aren't, you know, like, who know your stats, but, oh, you're
right.
a hero.
Because a coach is the most important guy until he's not your coach anymore.
Yeah. And,
mm-hmm.
the, you know.
And there are several of those men in the story.
Right.
Yeah.
And they know all about what you need to do to improve your game. But the, like, childhood self that found joy in meaning on the court
yeah.
and in the joy of the game, that's what's going to keep you alive.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and that's like the most important
thing. I really,
yeah.
His lack of understanding of what's going on in Benghazi when the violence begins really adds to the fear factor. And,
yeah.
and in a way, if it was a journalist telling us that story who
right.
could give more context,
right.
it might be less scary, or it might be more scary, but because the context is chilling. But
yeah, it would certainly be different.
Yes.
It would be different.
yeah.
And his he looks out the window. He sees people being shot by the army. He doesn't know, he has no idea what's going on. He, and the way in which he manages to survive, those details of, you know, drinking the toilet water, drinking the rainwater in the plant pots outside, right. And then the toilet leaking and him just pushing the duvet against the into the hallway against the bathroom door just to just soak up the mess that's coming through. And the moment where he wakes up with that the sewage on his face and he thinks the water's back on. Those details are so brilliantly captured. It's really visceral.
Absolutely.
How skinny he's getting. What do you do? You know, eating the bugs. The moment where he gets the cockroaches. And then he squashes one, eats it, and it's disgusting. And he remembers.
That's not the way to eat a cockroach.
Yeah, I saw Bear Grylls.
That one detail.
On a reality TV. You don't squash it.
Put them straight down while they're alive.
Right, right. Well, and I mean, those children were amazing. And the fact that he doesn't, like, know that they're not going to leave.
And the
death.
Fact that you're not. I wasn't that worried about the kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're living in this horrific situation, this civil war, essentially. But but the kids just seem, they're so streetwise.
Yeah.
It seems like they're not the ones we're worried about. Worried about this big 6'5" guy.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Wearing Nikes.
Well, and that, yes. And
he's been threatened by children in other parts of the book,
and
too.
That's one of my favorite parts of the book. Is like these, you know, children that help him are mirrored by the...
Macedonian kids.
The Macedonian, little monsters. A little baby child with an eye patch holding a smaller baby.
Yeah.
Put money.
Yeah, they're threatening him and trying to scam him and they're threatening him.
Yeah.
And he's scared.
Absolutely
scared.
How do you fight those kids? You don't fight those kids.
Yeah.
Chasing them through the streets.
Because,
it's a giant mass of little tiny evil babies. what a crazy journey. He went
some great images.
Yeah.
When he's at the border trying to get into Egypt in the detention center waiting, and he's scavenging in the trash for any bits of food, and he sees a girl look at him and he sees himself
as this tracksuit
cool guy. Tracksuit with his
expensive
Nike,
expensive athletic gear, but.
Like
a mess.
Yeah.
It's a great image.
Yeah, it totally is. And he's trying to be polite all the time, too. And he's a complete putrid mess, but wearing expensive athletic gear and clearly, really tall and but just shriveled and stinking. And it's just crazy.
Yeah, he's only ever done one thing, really, which is train and practice.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, what do you do?
Right.
You know, his downtime says something about him. He'll try and Skype with his family.
Yeah, and he prays a lot.
Yeah, or he'll watch Rush Hour 3 again.
I just love that movie.
Beverly Hills Cop.
and you know, there's a point where you can get where everything is so noisy and messy when you just need to watch a film like that.
Right,
mm-hmm. It's the only way.
Yeah. Well, and I love the bit where he's suggesting that him and his family could be that they're like a Skype poster family. He's marveling at just how cool the modern world is, despite the fact that, you know, very shortly thereafter, the modern world is exploding outside his window, that he's just loving that he lives in this moment of time where, you know, and could a story like his exist in any other age? I mean, never mind the revolutionary parts, but. You know, that he's a Nigerian prince.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Basically. And
who moved to Boston.
Yeah. And, that's, and that what a prince means, like you were saying.
Yeah, before. It was so interesting just to learn some things about what it was like to be a certain kind of person in Nigeria and what wealth means in Nigeria and what royalty is in Nigeria. The idea that, his father was one of 67 children.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 67 children! Which he first is apologizing that he doesn't exactly know how many cousins he has in the village.
Uh-huh.
And then he has to back up and say, well, there are a lot, because my father was one of 67 children and proceeded to have 27 wives. And so I don't know how many, brothers and sisters that Alex has. Right. But that's what a wealthy person does in Nigeria.
Right.
We don't wealthy people just don't really, that's not really what we do here. And I didn't know that. Like, right. I'm so ignorant of other cultures. And this is such a personal story that really has nothing to do with life in Nigeria, political conflict, you know, what's going on with anything. It's not even about sports, really. Right. It's just about this guy and the crazy, like, life that he that kind of happened to him. Right. And all of the situations are so interesting and so nothing. I've never known anything about this stuff,
right,
from international basketball to life as a wealthy person in Nigeria. Again, with the education, who knew that the education situation was so high powered that it wasn't unusual, I guess, very high focused on math and science. And it was not unusual for these young Nigerians to be going off to American colleges at 15 or 16, having excelled. And I just don't know anything about Nigeria, and it was fascinating.
Well, in terms of, like, world events swirling around these personal stories, I love the love story aspect.
Yeah.
And that Alex meets Alexis, who's, you know,
he could only meet someone with almost his own name.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean that cruelly.
Narcissistic,
but it is focused. Let's say this is my focus.
She must be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Focused, yes.
But she sounds perfect.
Well, yes, yeah. And this beautiful girl that, you know, her background is New Orleans, and, you know, and just her whole history has been devastated by Katrina and the after effects of Katrina. And I mean, his history has been turbulent up until this point, but it reaches this sort of orchestral literary correctness when like there isn't much follow up. He's going home to her and he's had this triumph and he's been through all this stuff, but you feel like she's like the only woman you can imagine that could, you know, that will be actually like thankful, you know, for the opportunity to help him work through this stuff, and that has all this actual carnage and horror in her own background, and has managed to find like sweetness, who can present herself as a sweet, you know, like loving person despite all the horror in her background. And I just know they're going to be great together. I mean, if I get on Wikipedia after this and find that they broke up, I'm going to do something drastic. But
they're Skyping right now.
Right. Yeah. They're Skyping as we speak. And there must be an endorsement deal. I know there's movie buzz around this book, and no doubt there'll be a huge Skype endorsement. Something else, speaking of the Alex thing, the fact that he goes to Macedonia, hometown of Alexander the Great, and is hailed. And I love the book kind of lightly, you know, I mean, okay, he's a sports hero, a kind of, you know, minor sports hero in his way, but the fact that athletes have this mantle of heroism placed upon them, and the book kind of, you know, like touches on these kind of like different models of heroism. Like, we speak of Alexander the Great, you know, this great, you know, he built, you know, the greatest empire that the world had thus far seen. And Gaddafi is this, you know, like heroic figure until everything starts to go to hell. Heroic figure from a distance, as long as you just care about basketball, you're not really asking.
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing too, about like what
growing up in Nigeria, he saw Gaddafi.
As, Gaddafi was positive.
As a benevolent. Talking about heroism.
Yes.
There's a point at which, I mean, one thing that's interesting to me in this book is the glamour of America.
Yes.
As a child, becoming obsessed with basketball, the NBA is where it's at, and it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he becomes obsessed with these figures that he can see on VHS. And so to finally move to America is a great moment in his young life.
Right.
But also, then when he travels abroad, it's very much as an American.
Yeah.
You know, he's very much in Libya as an American because he's playing basketball. It's not as a Nigerian.
Right.
I mean, and I wonder, it's almost like, because I don't know much about basketball, and I don't know Alex, and I don't know how good he actually is. I can only take his word that he was close enough to the NBA draft to be excited on draft day. I can only know from what he tells me how good he is.
Yeah.
And But he arrives in these different countries as an American.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a tall, athletic American.
Right.
It's almost like I imagine jazz musicians. Uh-huh. You could be American and you could go to... you can be an African American and go to Paris.
Yeah.
And people will give you a certain credibility.
Right.
Because America created this.
Right.
This
right.
is an American thing.
Yeah.
And you have an authenticity. I wonder how much of that comes with... you know, there are Americans all over the planet right. playing basketball.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's similar to, it always strikes me as interesting when you see reports from any event anywhere around the world. Huh. You can go to the smallest village in Bangladesh where there's floods, go to the Sudan where there are people starving, and you will see a Yankees cap, or you'll see a Manchester United
right.
jersey. You'll right. see something from the Western world. You'll see an AC/DC t-shirt. You know, you'll see this... Yeah. Yeah. The power of Western culture uh-huh. on the rest of the world is really interesting. And I mean, and that's why he plays basketball.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know,
that's why he started playing.
Yes. Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, that's what started him playing, and, you know, and his goals are definitely in that, you know, like that sort of diadem of, you know, of Dennis Rodman, Magic mm-hmm. Johnsonism. But what I like in terms of his education and his journey leading up to Libya is that sort of detour he takes into that rural, deeply religious college.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, his career choices could be erratic, but right. his logic is sound.
Yeah, well, yeah, and like him not even knowing that he needed that, but what that felt like and the way he describes that experience... The constant prayer and the orientation mm-hmm. of his athletic self towards this like meditative saintly state.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, like that, those passages to me, like, you know, I could connect that to whatever I've, you know, experienced mm-hmm. as a writer, what I think anyone can experience in whatever like form seems to like make their whole life mean something. And you know, and he almost never he prays a lot after the fact, but he never kind of like goes to that place. He's still worried about his career. Then he's worried about surviving and then there are career issues again. But having that in the book, this experience he had where after all the striving and the hustling and, oh, and I blew this and, you know, and, oh, but I can't believe you took this away from me for a stupid reason. And what the hell, and my report card and, uh-huh. you know, and just all this sort of like scrabbling and shucking and jiving, I felt like it was almost this like, you know, religious reorientation towards like the spiritual power of basketball.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. what's happening in that place.
Yeah, beyond his career, yeah. just to play.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And not even just for the, not for, not even this, I mean, you see how it's like not even just for the player and not even just for the players and for the game, but for the people. Like, there's just this thing, like in the middle of political unrest and everything, like in the middle of these crazy situations, it's like, I'm not one of these people who are into sports. I'm just like, what? But, but you can see that for so many people, it's this thing that's like the best thing, like a saving grace of like joy in their lives.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, well, interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's someone, I mean, for like the spectator, it's something where you can invest your faith and identity in one side or the other mm-hmm. or one player over another player. And it's a way for like the like struggles to get resolved in a way where there isn't a body count and, you know, that is uncomplicated by politics. And you can see the kind of like weird, almost perverse appeal that might have for Gaddafi's
absolutely,
and for Idi Amin's or, you know. Or,
well, and then the flip side of that is there's an authenticity to owning a sporting team.
Yeah.
There's a ceremony
right.
involved that doesn't involve
right.
killing people or political maneuverings necessarily on the field
right.
or on the court. It all makes sense.
Yeah.
And you can sit in the crowd and you can wave like Caesar.
Right.
Yeah, it's a hell of a satisfaction.
But that's what, like, the Macedonia chapter is great because of, I mean, the tensions in that part of the world, ethnically, politically, religiously,
right.
are completely alien to Alex.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's got Albanians on his team.
Yeah.
Who, and he lives in the Albanian quarter. It only dawns on him as they're playing a game where people are throwing bottles at them, people are burning the Albanian flag. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right.
People can, in a time of relative peace, use these sporting occasions. And so many sporting clubs, people don't just necessarily start a sporting... There have been so many... I think about in the UK when so many soccer teams came from the church or from this idea of we have to keep our boys active so they don't touch themselves.
Uh-huh.
There's this kind of evangelical zeal to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so many teams which, I mean, you can look through the history of sport, and especially in Europe, where, oh, these guys were the fascist team.
Right.
These guys were the army team. These guys were the police. These guys were the rebels. And people hold on to those identities. They matter.
Right.
In a way that when you're an athlete, you want to play.
Yeah.
I'll play for these guys.
Yeah.
Who are you playing for?
Right.
You know, are you playing for the fascists? Are you playing for the communists? Yeah. Are you playing for the Muslims, the Christians? Right. You don't necessarily care.
Right.
You want to play. Like, these seem like good guys. I'll play.
Yeah. And you maybe know somebody. Know somebody who's on the team. Yeah. They're no.
I'm in an apartment, and they're paying me all this money. And but what does it mean?
Yeah.
His naivety and innocence when it comes to this is really compelling.
So yes. Fabulous, like. I mean, at least within all the content of the book, he never even seems to wonder or ask the question.
Or look back and say, should I have gone here for like moral reasons rather than because my family were worried about me?
Yeah.
Should I have taken this money? Should I have investigated further? He doesn't ask that
question. He doesn't even go, hey, Coach Sharif, or hey,
who are we?
Hey, Mustafa. What was going on there anyway?
Yeah.
Like, are we the bad guys? It's never even brought up. Like, who's who here and what was that about? He never... even asks it, as far as we know.
Those moments in the apartment in Benghazi and later in that cell that he's locked in when he's trying to get out of the country.
Oh, yeah.
Where he, again, has to establish contact with his sloughed former selves to maintain any kind of sanity. I mean, those are beautiful moments that you wouldn't expect to find in a sports memoir.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
But there's also something about his great strength of character, what at times seems like shallowness or selfishness, as we've said. It makes me feel like someone more introspective or someone who interrogates themselves more might be... totally destroyed for life by these experiences.
Absolutely. Whereas he has a series of mantras that he falls back on.
Yeah.
Must practice harder.
Yeah.
Must get in shape.
It's like,
love my family, love God. Boom, boom, boom.
Right.
That can seem like he's in denial, and yet just keeps pushing him on.
It's a way of he can keep his... That's why I think we find it kind of admirable, is because somehow this combination of ways that he deals with situations, the way that he thinks, they all enable him to maintain his focus.
Right.
And then maintaining his focus keeps him on his game and keeps him doing what he loves.
Right.
And we all want to be doing that, you know?
Yeah.
And here's this funny dude.
Right.
And he's found a way to stay focused, which is funny. It's different. Like the difference between being introspective and being focused.
Right.
The difference between being selfish and focused. Like, I feel like he's actually not that selfish, but he's so focused that he does things that you would maybe consider selfish.
Right.
But I think it's a focus that he has.
Right.
Partly just...
Well, you know, I mean, not to be, too much of a suck-ass in this context, but...
Go on.
Oh, what
wait.
The hell?
Who's asked you going to suck? What's it going to be?
Well, Kevin Undergaro, who with Maria Menounos runs the whole AfterBuzz enterprise and by extension Book Circle Online. He, you know, over the years, I mean, I first met him when he was a substitute teacher of mine in high school. And,
really?
Yeah. And so he's...
Did you give him a hard time then?
Not in any way that he didn't like, I don't think, and you know, hence our enduring relationship. But he's certainly, he's had a you know, he's been a mentor to me over the years.
A coach, even,
you know, and to varying degrees based on how much I was willing to listen, you know.
Be a team player, Jason.
Well, yeah, sometimes, you know, I maybe not looked out for myself as much as I should. It's the same thing, right? it's the biota. Mm-hmm. Further the interests of the biota mm-hmm. through individual achievement. But
Coach Sharif.
Right, Coach Sharif, go. Kevin, you know, like, is not a super sportsy guy, but he knows about sports and has often used sports analogies in trying to...
They're very effective.
Well, they can be, and, and sometimes they'll get involved in specific and they'll kind of baffle me. And, okay, I guess I get that. And then I'll like want to like watch some of the game he's referring to. So I'll, you know, know what exactly he's getting at. But I kept thinking of that relationship and, you know, and bits of wisdom that he's imparted to me whilst listening to Alex's, you know, relationships with his coaches and the fact that, you know, like the fundamental, you know, the kind of life shaping influence that a sport can have
mm-hmm.
or that seems to have is that you're going to have all sorts of personal problems. You're going to have you're going to be tugged in all these mm-hmm. different directions, but you know where the court is.
Yeah.
You know, and
like, you know who's winning.
And you
know,
the
school board.
Yeah. And, you know, and even if it's before, like, the numbers are up and it's just you and that basket.
Yeah.
I mean, that moment when Alex is washing his hands and his coach walks up and he thinks he's awesome and it's a bit of theater, but the coach is pretending to wash his hands just so he can wait for that moment where their eyes can meet in the mirror. You need to practice harder. And that it's not a judgment.
I nodded at that.
Yeah.
He's right. I do.
Right. No, totally.
I do.
I felt it and it, you know, and I, and that coach looked like Kevin to me. And that, I'm sorry, Chief.
But also they're telling you that it's worth it.
Yeah.
That you're good enough.
Right.
You should practice harder,
because,
not
yeah.
you should find a plan B.
Right,
it's
right,
like
right,
you,
yeah.
You need to apply yourself.
Right.
It's worth it.
Right.
That's
not
what...
we've all made a terrible mistake. Yeah.
Hi, Kevin.
This Alex's journey has brought me closer to Kevin.
I think we all feel closer to Kevin.
I think
now.
We all do. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Anyway, we're going to cut all this out.
It's fun to perform, though, knowing that you could
it
just
is.
Go
have
for
a specific
it.
Listener. I know. What the hell?
So, can I say something weird?
I've been reading
Empire of the Sun, J.G. Ballard.
Really?
It's 5 years since his death.
Yeah.
And I've been reading that. I read the first 50 pages, stopped to read this book.
Okay.
Gone back to Empire of the Sun. It's the same story.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
It's the same story. In Empire of the Sun, the young Jim, uh-huh. loosely based on J.G. Ballard himself, is in Shanghai, the Japanese invade. He spends time in different apartments looking for food, hiding out from soldiers outside, not knowing what's going on.
No shit.
He ends up trying to escape. He ends up in a camp waiting to hopefully move somewhere else to another camp. It's the same story.
Right. Wow. Wow.
This happens to me all the time.
Uh-huh.
I read a book, I read another book, it's the same book.
Right.
I read one book. It's the same book over and over.
Interesting. Well,
those are
begs the
crazy
question.
Combination,
well,
though.
Yeah, but
completely
I,
different.
Because
and yet,
this is not Annihilation.
No.
Right. No. True enough. But
that's amazing. I haven't read Empire of the Sun. I don't even know what it's about.
But something. No doubt. Well, but you know, but something presenting itself as a memoir. I mean, there's you know some structure of verisimilitude, mm. but the body of the memoir is a quasi-sophisticated person,
mm-hmm.
but still childlike,
yeah.
you know, who doesn't know it, and, like, trapped in circumstances.
A lot of the joy in Empire of the Sun comes from realizing that the young Jim doesn't quite understand his situation. As streetwise as he is,
yeah.
he doesn't quite realize really how dangerous it is.
Well, yeah.
How dangerous like the Japanese are to him. Right, right, yes. Absolutely. And it's, you're only and it's like with, Alex in a
you,
way.
Yeah, right, you don't have any macro view. Right, it's like right, you're right. only
And
like,
who does, ultimately?
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, but, people have an illusion that they do, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all, or, we think we know it all.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but but like that those characters get to experience this terror, maybe we don't get all the finer points and the details and the ramifications, but they don't have any of the bigotries mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. preconceived notions and assessments that would make this a piece of journalism.
Absolutely.
We get the poetry. And I think, I mean, certainly Empire of the Sun is a poetic document, but Gaddafi's point guard is running riot with poetical moments. I felt surprised by its poetry.
Yeah.
Throughout.
Yeah. I was surprised
and,
all
and
way
it's
along.
The imagery. It's lying under the blanket on the back of the bus,
right?
With another oversized guy,
yeah.
Trying to escape.
Yeah,
wearing the kind of dirty, now dirty but previously immaculate sportswear in a camp. When you're trying to escape to Egypt,
right. And whenever and
countries
when
he doesn't know, couldn't put them up, point them out on a map,
and right. he's under the second blanket in the back of the second bus, and it's being searched by the soldiers or the police or whatever, and
he sees the boots of the,
and
soldier walking
the people
up.
On the bus are protecting him,
yeah.
And he doesn't know, he doesn't, like, there's the language thing, he doesn't know.
Right, he doesn't know why they're helping him.
Yeah, he doesn't know why they're helping
and
him.
And he still doesn't.
He yeah. still doesn't, yeah. But all the people on the bus, they acted for the
right,
soldier
right.
and totally sold it. That
right.
no, we're cool. Like,
yeah.
you know,
we're
like,
just Egyptians on
yeah,
this bus.
Yeah, we're
right.
on this bus.
And
we're
and
all Egyptians. Like, what the hell? All the Egyptians were helping smuggle
right.
him.
And
right.
that's when he has to resort to this cliched language about them being angels. Because what
right.
else can you say
yeah.
in the face
right,
of that?
Right.
You have
yeah.
to come
they don't
back
even
to this.
Know you.
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
well, and that's why.
And they risk their lives.
Yeah.
Like, for reasons that you have no idea why.
Right.
I mean.
Right. And to experience these earth-shattering events through the eyes of someone without those bigotries or preconceived notions who can experience things that way,
mm-hmm.
it's amazing. I mean, we get this human element, and the fact that there will always be those figures who have a vested interest, who are lobbing the bombs or directing the lobbing of the bombs, or who are mounting the guns and the SUVs, or who are on... You know, on television, you know, spouting the manifestos, and there are those people,
and
then there's everybody else
yeah.
who's just
yeah.
trying to fucking survive this shit. That
yeah.
all these people who really believe in things,
because most
know,
people
yeah.
I think just want to say, just leave me alone.
Yes,
yeah.
just leave. Just
yeah.
let me do my thing. That's what most of it. And in some ways, there's a guilt attached to that because by saying that, you're complicit somehow.
Right,
but
yeah, by not,
that's
like,
complicated.
Well,
yeah,
no,
it's like by not being a political activist
yeah,
that
right.
now you're like an enabler.
By not saying
of,
no,
yeah.
you're saying
yeah.
yes.
Well, yeah, because but it's not. I feel like, you know, the kind of humanity that we encounter in these situations and in these narratives, it's not like leave me alone. I just want to build a fence and get away from you people.
No.
It's like leave me alone and just stop hurting people.
Yeah,
you know? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, stop.
And that's why
people.
To judge Alex for any of his decisions in his career,
yeah,
is to judge yourself, really.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ultimately, what you know, he's a guy just trying to play the game.
Right. Yeah, and to pass judgment on him is say, okay, so the alternative is to be like someone who's really, you know, committed to some political idea or something, but that's the guy with the gun on top of the SUV.
Right, right.
I mean, he really believes in what he's
yeah.
doing.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm, you know, stone cold, but I would be more likely to castigate the mother for saying that him not coming home was going to kill the father when the father would never have said that thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
was the mother freaking out. And, you know,
right.
obviously she's in an incredibly hard to deal with situation.
Right.
But she's lobbing that at
yeah.
him against his life, against his career, and also against what his father always taught him.
Right. Well, okay, but that's well, and also,
but see, maybe I'm a hard boiled bitch.
No,
I don't think.
No, I think these are all complicated people because
yeah.
also Coach Sharif. I really think Alex needs to work through this stuff. He wants Alex on his basketball
yeah.
team,
mm-hmm.
but that other stuff is true. You know, mean, you can, he makes a case.
And I think it really turned out to be true. And it's true that he wasn't doing it.
Well, you think so because you've read Alex's book.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And right. because if Alex read, really came around.
If you read Alexis's book, I'm waiting for Alex to come home.
Yeah.
You might not agree.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
And
except for, except for that I'm an artist and I admire artists who like, who do shut out everything else and follow their thing. So I don't know that I never.
His reasons seem to be innocent, and so you could. That's why it's fine for him.
Or at least if he's guilty, he's guilty of something that I also agree with. So I would be more likely to identify with Alex than with all of his suffering family crying and rending their garments and waiting at home for him to please come home, Alex. I mean, he's out there like having an adventure and living his life and going as far as he can. Go, Alex!
Go, Alex! Eat those roaches. All right. Well, okay, this has been a lively dissection. Do we have any closing arguments aside from our cheering on of the of Alex's single-minded, selfish pursuit?
I really love the idea of having some comparative analysis of dual literary works.
Wouldn't that be fun to have?
I do it every week.
Right? Yeah.
It seems like these things just echo.
Right.
Yeah.
When you're saturated in something, it just... it's everywhere.
Right.
Yeah, I totally, like, I can't think of a good example right now, but exactly what you described, it happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
And I love to go over it and over it. And I mean, you know, we can have book polygon.
Right. True enough. Well, okay. And we'll have to.
Parallelogram online.
Right. Well, yes. No, I love that idea. We'll have to pick and choose and be studious about it because I'm, at around the same time, I've been reading Gaddafi's Point Guard. I've been reading the massive new William Burroughs biography by Barry Miles.
And they're the same guy?
No.
No.
That's what I'm saying.
North Africa?
It doesn't always work.
North Africa?
I'm not there
yet. The drug trade?
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, you could bend over backwards and wedge it in sideways, but... really, almost antithetical.
Talking about antithesis is okay, too.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I feel like it's kind of... I mean, as if we don't have enough to read already.
Yeah, right.
Here I am, a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, look at this. See?
I love being a champion
is all about being a glutton for punishment. I guess so. Thank you, Alex, for teaching us that.
Yes.
Anyway, So here we are. We've been picking Gaddafi's Point Guard to lovely
pick and roll.
Dribbling peaches. Yes, dribble. And yes, it's been great. We love this book. And we love Gaddafi. No, we don't. We love Alex Away.
Wait, we love Alex.
And we love Alexis, his ravishing consort.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's really pretty.
Yes, I hope he develops a competing memoir or, you know, perhaps a video. Yes. It's been lovely. I'm Jason Squamata for Book Circle Online. And just reminding you that if you dig these Book Circle podcasts, whatever vector you're receiving them through, check them out on iTunes. Download them through iTunes.
Why should we do that?
Because then you can leave comments, okay? Yep. That makes us more popular and more powerful and more enabled to do more expansive, extensive, and engaging podcasts in this Book Circle mode. And we can start a conversation. You leave comments on iTunes and we're gonna come at you. We're gonna talk about them, and we want to accumulate an army of Book Circle super fans.
Feed it, and it grows.
Yeah, precisely. Mm-hmm. Okay, like with anything.
Yeah. I'm gonna assume alter identities. Yeah, I'm gonna comment.
That's fine. Don't you want to see Kate Fenker in various?
I'm gonna troll myself.
Identity. She's trolling herself as we speak.
Like,
if you want to see video of Kate Fenker trolling herself,
you mean Kat Fonka?
Kat Fonka, if you will. As they say on the Raper Bar.
Kit Fanka.
Kit Fanka. Yes, waiting in a window, in a virtual window on your internet Raper Bar. Kit Fanka for Book Circle Online. Yes, the possibilities are endless, but let's get this rolling, people. iTunes, YouTube, BookCircleOnline.com. But hit that iTunes up and let's see what happens. Let's start a conversation. That's all I'm saying.
Yes.
I'm Jason Squamata.
I'm Mark Savage.
I'm Kat Funka.
Kat Funka! Yeah! And we are beaming live from the libraries of Maria Menounos, and we have been talking about Gaddafi's point guard. Keep it bookish, keep it circular, keep reading alive. Ink blots turning into dreams in your mind as you read them. That's real. That's what a book is. Go read some books. Thank you.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO. Join the circle.